He introduced the book of Esther. This is the book where God's name is never even mentioned one time. But in fact, God is seen all the way through as the unsung, unseen hero of the book, the hero of history. And so Esther's contribution to the canon of Scripture is the truth that God is at work, quote, behind the scenes to accomplish all his good pleasure. Now, without Esther, we really could not see behind the scenes because this is the only book that really is dedicated to pulling back the curtains so that we can see behind history to the personal orchestrator of history. And his orchestration involves all the little details of history, what people subjectively call oftentimes the minor details of life. But how do we know that something is a minor detail? That question itself reveals the fallacy that really we are in no position as mere finite human beings who are limited in our knowledge and certainly don't know the future other than what God has revealed to declare anything to be a minor detail. And certainly when we think about the minor details through the lens of Esther, we see that many of the so-called minor details don't really turn out to be minor at all, but they tend to be key events in history. So the doctrine of providence is stating that God is at work behind the scenes in every detail of life. Now, today the doctrine of providence and God's sovereignty have fallen on hard times in many Christian circles. But nevertheless, this is true, and what many people are struggling with today is they'll say, well, if God is providential and he's sovereign over every little detail of life, then that makes man just a robot. Now, that's not what this is saying. This will be on your handout in a moment, but that's what we call fatalism. And we must never fall into the trap of fatalism. We can turn that on. I don't have any. Can we turn that light on? I'm not going to use any computer. Oh, thanks. That's better for me. Is that bad for y'all? Well, we can turn it off. You're not accustomed to it. Is that okay? Okay, well, I'll adjust to that light after a few moments. Just if we got captured up in glory right now, I imagine we'd all be blinded like the Apostle Saul. All right, well, what many people are saying today is that, well, the doctrine of the sovereignty of God and the providence of God, that we don't like this because this means that if God is in control of every detail of life, that makes man a robot. And that's the error, as I said, called fatalism. And we don't want to trip into this trap. History, of course, is not fatalism. Fatalism says, que sera, sera. You know, whatever will be. And logically, if that's the case, then I can just sit on my haunches here and do absolutely nothing, and God's plan is going to come pass anyway. Now, that's not biblical, obviously. At the same time, however, it's equally wrong to say that man's libertarian free will choices are what give shape to history. So this is the other side, or the opposite view of on the contrary to fatalism, and this is chance. And we must never fall into this trap. Chance says history is open and it's undecided, and as man makes a move, you know, God understands then what move and what is going to come next, and he knows how to do a counter move. Now, that's not the biblical view of God or man or history or any of that. Neither of you are. Fatalism and chance are both pagan views of God, man, and nature. The biblical view is that is more complex. It's basically that God is providentially taking history to a definite point where he is taking it. And man is invited to enter into this history by making responsible choices. And the choices that man makes are very real, because if man did not make the certain decisions that he made, then the plan would not come to pass. And yet, at the same time, man's responsible choices are means that are a part of God's providential plan, and they're necessary. And yet every decision that every man makes is always exactly what man wants to do. Nobody's twisting his arm. Now, Esther shows us this biblical model of how God's providence and man's responsible decisions work throughout history. Okay, so if you don't understand how it all works and you didn't understand what I just said, that's okay. Just stick around because we're going to see this illustrated over and over, chapter after chapter in the book of Esther. And so as we go through Esther 1 tonight, we're looking to see what man always does what he wants to do, but at the same time, God's providential plans come to pass. Now, to introduce chapter 1, let me introduce the two main characters in this chapter, Ahasuerus and Vashti. All right, Ahasuerus is introduced in verse 1, and he's the king of Medo-Persia at the time. His name, Ahasuerus, here is the Hebrew name. It's how he was known among the Jews who spoke Hebrew. His name among the Persians was Shishayarsha. Mm-hmm. That's one of the more difficult ones I've ever faced. Shishayarsha. And so the Persians knew him by a different name, but this is written in Hebrew, and so his Hebrew name, Ahasuerus, is used here. Now, his Greek name is the name most historians refer to him by. For example, Herodotus, who gives us a lot of background about the Persians and their interactions with Greece. And the Greeks referred to him as Xerxes. And so I'm going to use that name a lot. That's the same as Ahasuerus, so don't get confused. In Daniel chapter 11, Ahasuerus was prophesied to rise to power. Not by name, but he was prophesied in Daniel 11, along with all those 130 or so other prophecies that we find in that chapter. In Daniel 11:2, the angel said, behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia, then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them, and as soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. That's Daniel 11:2. And the fourth king in that verse who would arise was Xerxes, the Ahasuerus here of verse 1. And he is the king who grew powerful through his wealth and then instigated an empire-wide campaign against the Greeks. The second main character in chapter 1 is his wife, Queen Vashti, and she's introduced in verse 9. She's often said to probably never have existed because she's nowhere mentioned anywhere else in extra-biblical literature. However, it's been shown again in Herodotus that her Greek name, the transliteration of it was Amestris. And she wasn't a very nice girl from what I've read in Herodotus. On one occasion, she was jealous of Xerxes' brother's wife because Xerxes, her husband, thought his brother's wife was not bad looking. And so what she did was she manipulated things to have this woman disfigured. And I won't take you through all the disturbing details. But when Xerxes' brother found out what had been done to his wife, he set out a plot to assassinate his brother, the king. And, of course, the king found out about this plot. And, well, the king destroyed his entire brother's family. So this girl, Queen Vashti, she's not a very nice girl. She's a very beautiful girl, but not very nice. So there was a lot of intrigue in this kingdom, like a lot of these Gentile kingdoms. Now, so those are the two main characters. There are several minor characters mentioned by name in chapter 1. Okay, 14 to be exact. But most notably, in verse 14, we meet Memucan. And Memucan is one of the seven princes there in verse 14. In verse 16, he goes into a big discourse. He was one of the wise men who understood the times in Persia. And we'll see what that means in a bit later, but he's the one who came up with the advice or counsel to banish Vashti out of the king's presence and replace her with someone else, and this advice was followed by the king. So there are your major and minor characters for chapter 1, and as we study the details, we're watching for God's providential behind-the-scenes work as well as man's choices. All right. Now, verses 1 to 4 is the first scene. There are about three or four scenes here. And I'll just take you through these. The king is holding a banquet in the first scene for 180 days. And this banquet serves, I think, basically as a cover for the military planning session that is going on in verse 3 against Greece. Okay, so in verse 1 we get the timing, the king who reigned and how big his kingdom was. Now it took place in the days of Ahasuerus, and we said Ahasuerus, that's his Hebrew name, right? That's how the Jews spoke about him. Okay, but we're going to refer to him as Xerxes because that's the name the Greeks gave him, and that's the name most people know this ruler by. So everything I cite from history isn't going to say Ahasuerus, it's going to say Xerxes, so why don't I just go ahead and use that name. Now, verse 1 tells us the extent of Xerxes' kingdom. He reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. Now, I gave you a map, and I've given you a better map this week. You can see everything in the green on that map is his kingdom. India corresponds in the west to modern, or in the east, excuse me, in the east to modern-day western portions of Pakistan. And Ethiopia corresponds to modern-day Sudan, as well as the northern portion of Ethiopia. Okay, so the Persian kingdom was a remarkably vast empire. It was far larger than the prior Gentile kingdom of Babylon. It engulfed all of Babylon, and it extended way beyond it. Okay, so it was in fact this is the largest empire in the history of the world up until this time. And in due time, of course, the Greek Empire would surpass it. And in due time after that, the Roman Empire would surpass even that. And at this very moment, a world empire is forming that will surpass and dwarf all previous kingdoms. But at that time, the Persian Empire, as you see on the map, was the greatest in extent the world had ever known. And Ahasuerus was the world's most powerful man. However, also note that the way the verse reads, it seems to imply that there was another Ahasuerus, and that the author is trying to make sure his audience knows which Ahasuerus he's talking about. Because he says, this was the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. And in fact, there was another Ahasuerus. His name is mentioned in the Bible in Daniel chapter 9, verse 1, and it's not the same one as this one. He was the father of Darius the Mede, who we found as we studied Daniel 9 was Gubaru, and that's his name, Gubaru. I know you remember that now, see? Everybody remembers that because that's an interesting moment. A guy named Gubaru. And his father was Ahasuerus, and that's in the Babylonian Chronicles. You can read all about Gubaru, okay? But this was another Ahasuerus. That one was a Median descent, and this one is a Persian descent. And that one did not rule over this entire realm, but this one did. And so the author is trying to distinguish which one he's referring to. Now, the very fact that he does that, and we're just making an observation here, the fact that he's trying to distinguish to his audience which Ahasuerus he's talking about indicates that the audience that he's writing to did not live during the reign of this king, or else, well, they wouldn't have had to have told him all these things. They would have known about these events. So when they were sitting in history class and they would hear about, well, there's Ahasuerus, he was the father of Darius the Mede, and there was this other Ahasuerus, and he was a ruler from India to Ethiopia. Now, which one of these was the king or ruler when Esther occurred? Well, verse 1 would answer that question for these history students. So it seems from this verse that whoever wrote Esther was writing to a younger generation that didn't see these events. And to me, this puts the date of the book during the reign of the next king, who's Artaxerxes Longimanus, who reigned from 465 or so on down to 424. The other point related to the writing of this book is that, you know, this chapter records a lot of details. I mean, especially about the 7-day banquet. It begins in verse 5, and there's a description of the decorations, the people that were present, the location in the gardens of the royal palace, the drinking vessels, the rules regarding the drinking, you know, happened specifically on the seventh day, the drunken condition of the king the seventh day, the names of the seven eunuchs, the names of the seven princes, the name of the prince that actually stood up to give counsel to the king, that was Memucan and not somebody else. All these details that occurred, catch this, 4 years before Esther ever married the king. 4 years before Mordecai ever enters the story. Now, where did the author get all this detailed information? Now, it sounds to me like, for all these details, whoever the author was, he personally attended the banquet. And that he was therefore an eyewitness. Okay, and years after these events unfolded, he looked back and what he saw was God's providential hand at work. Okay? Now, that is how providence works. Okay? You can't tell in the midst of the situation the importance of some little factor. It's only in hindsight that you can detect the hand of God was shaping, it was constructing, it was organizing history to set up for the next part of His plan. Now, it's the same exact way in our lives. We look back and we can see how God was orchestrating the events of our life to bring about the present situation, where we are now, what we're doing, all these things. But we couldn't see it when these little details were happening. Okay? It's important, though, to realize that God, even right now in your life, is setting up things for the future. In other words, your responsibility to God is to always live in a continual acknowledgement that He is shaping your life. So we see in verse 1, the king is Ahasuerus and God is shaping something that's not even going to take place for another 4 years. The one who reigned over this realm had control of 127 provinces. Okay? All the events, verse 1 tells us, occurred in the days of this king. So what are the days of this king? What are the dates? Well, he came to the throne, he acceded to the throne in 486 B.C., upon the death of his father, Darius the First. But since they didn't count the accession year as a regal year, it was the accession year, then his first year of his regal reign, as referred to in this verse, was 485 B.C., and he's going to reign until 465 B.C. when he's going to be assassinated in his bedchambers by Artabanus, his vizier. He had some political dreams, see? You know, lots of these people did. So the events in this book occur somewhere between 485 and 465 B.C. And verse 3 gives us more specificity because it says they begin in the third year of his reign. So since the first year was 485, the second year was 484, then that makes the third year 483. So verse 3 is referring to 483 B.C. Now you see in verse 2, as we move on, where the king was in 483 B.C. In those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was at the citadel in Susa. Now, he's being very specific. You say, why do you got to tell me it's at the royal palace, the royal throne in Susa? Well, because he had lots of royal houses and royal thrones. So he had one in the south, and if you look at your map, I know it's not the easiest map to read, but Susa is somewhere right out in the center, and that's where he was here in for these events. But south of that, and a little bit to the east, there's Persepolis. And Persepolis, or Persepolis. Now, Persepolis was his primary residence. This is where he spent most of his time. And he had a royal throne there. It was a very lavish city and a palace. And then in the north of Susa, he had a palace at Ecbatana. And you can see that on the map. Ecbatana. And Ecbatana was his summer palace. You know, wouldn't it be so nice, you know, when you get hot, you know, you go up north to Ecbatana. When it gets cold, you go down south to Susa, which was higher elevation and so forth. This way you always have the perfect conditions, okay? So he's at Susa, and it's right between Ecbatana and Persepolis, and this is his winter palace. So these events occurred, we would say, probably during the winter. Right? Now, Susa is the Greek word for the Hebrew Shushan. And this is interesting because Daniel found himself in a vision at Shushan, at Susa. And that's in Daniel chapter 8. Remember, we studied the great vision that he saw of a ram with two horns. And one of the horns came up first, and then the other one came up second, but the second one grew larger than the first. And then there was this buck goat that came into the picture. And he had one big horn between his eyes, and he went up, and he and this ram clashed. And when the ram with one horn got clashed with this buck goat, the buck goat shattered both of the horns of the ram, and the buck goat trampled him down under his feet. And this was a prophecy that Daniel saw in Susa. He was in vision at Susa, and it pictured the Medo-Persian Empire being crushed by the Greeks. And of course, the Greek who conquered them was none other than Alexander the Great. And so this occurred in 331 B.C. That's when Daniel found himself in vision at Susa, which would have been about 150 years after what happens here with Esther in the city of Susa. All right, so he's at Susa, and in verse 3, we were told it's the third year of his reign. We said that's 483 B.C., and now we go to the banquet in verses 3 and 4. You notice, first of all, at the end of verse 4, this banquet lasts 180 days, which is exactly half a year, 6 months. And after that, in verse 5, there's another banquet, and it lasts just 7 days. And it's held out in the Royal Garden Parks. How nice. Now, I would argue from all the facts that we have here, the fact that, first of all, that Susa was the winter palace, and the banquet that he held at Susa was probably, therefore, indoors, and it was a six-month banquet. And then that began, let's say, the last few months of 483, and that's going to take you all the way into the early spring in 482 B.C., and then he goes outdoors and they have a seven-day banquet in the Royal Garden Park because everything's coming into full blossom. So these events begin, we see, at the end of 483 B.C., and they end up in the early spring of 482 B.C. Then he's going to launch his military campaign in 481 B.C., and he's going to return and marry Esther in 479, 478 B.C. So you see that the events that occurred in chapter 1 occurred 4 years before Esther ever comes into the picture. And what this shows you, again, is how far-reaching God's providence is. It goes back. It's shaping, constructing something many, many years in advance to create the necessary conditions that no one at the time, Esther and Mordecai, had no idea that these events would shape up and be necessary to produce what's going to happen in chapter 2. But that's the way God works. All right, so in verse 3, the king gave a banquet for all his princes and attendants, the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence. Now, we'll make note of two facts here. First of all, the order of Persia and Media. Persia is mentioned before Media. Now, we already said that this kingdom had two branches, and Daniel predicted in Daniel chapter 8 that envisioned that Media would be the first and strongest branch of the kingdom, but then the second horn, you know, it would grow up and it would get larger and it would become dominant, and that's Persia. So by this time, you see Persia is mentioned before Media, and that indicates that Persia was the stronger branch at this time. The second thing we'll observe is that the banquet was given basically for government and military personnel. Okay? And they're from all his provinces, we might say a third thing. That's 127 provinces. So it was a kingdom-wide banquet involving everybody that would be involved in a military campaign. And the extent of it shows you how it's a kingdom-wide campaign, just like Daniel 11:2 said it would be. A very large campaign. And so what I'm suggesting is that really, while this sounds like, oh, it's just a big party for 180 days, what it really is a cover for the final stages of their military strategy to conquer Greece. Now, you have a handout now because somebody was gracious enough to do all that to try to get it handed out. And there is a quote, you know, from Herodotus. I think it's the first one. It's the first big quote. down on the page, about on the left side, about midway down, and it's a long quote, and this is what Herodotus said. He said, after the conquest of Egypt, intending now to take in hand the expedition against Athens, Xerxes held a special assembly of the noblest among the Persians, so he could learn their opinions and declare his will before them all. When they were assembled, Xerxes spoke to them as follows, it is my intent to bridge the Hellespont and lead my army through Europe to Hellas, so I may punish the Athenians for what they have done to the Persians and to my father. On his behalf and that of all the Persians, I will never rest until I have taken Athens and burn it for the unprovoked wrong that its people did to my father and me. Now, you can see then that this plan that is being strategized in Esther 1:3 goes back, Herodotus says, to an unprovoked wrong committed against Xerxes and the Persian people and his father in particular. Now, when he says there was an unprovoked wrong committed against by the Athenians, he's referring to the Athenians' military assistance in the Ionian Revolt, which occurred in 499 to 493 B.C. Now, what happened was, you know the area where the seven churches of Asia are, over in western Turkey, that area was known as Ionia. And there were several places like Miletus and Smyrna, several places, some of which were the seven churches of the book of Revelation. But long before all that came along, the Persians in those cities, or the people that were subjugated to the Persians, part of the Persian Empire, rebelled against Persian rule and tried to overthrow it. And what happened was the Athenians, these Greeks, came over and sent military aid to them to help them overturn Persian rule. Now, this was the unprovoked aggression by the Athenians. And it really made Xerxes and his father, especially Darius I, mad. After that happened, Darius swore he would burn Athens to the ground. So, Darius launched his campaign, and the first thing he did was he had to put down the Ionian Revolt, and he was successful at the Battle of Lade in 494, but his plan to burn down Athens was repelled by the Greeks at a very famous battle, which you know is the Battle of Marathon in 490 B.C. You know it because if you ever ran a battle, you ever read a, well, it is a battle to run a marathon. But that is the distance of that race, 26.2 miles, came out of the distance that, you know, this man supposedly ran after the Battle of Marathon. So Darius was defeated at the Battle of Marathon. And upon returning home, he decided he had to raise a massive army, and this time he would go back and he would subjugate all of Greece. However, this campaign never occurred because then the Egyptians, who were also in his realm, as you can see on the map, rebelled, and he had to go on and put down that rebellion. In 486 BC, he died, having never accomplished his revenge against Athens. So when his son Xerxes came to the throne, and he's the king we're interested in this book, he quickly put down the Egyptian revolt in 484 BC, and then he turned his attention to fulfilling his father's dreams, which was to burn Athens for this unprovoked wrong committed during the Ionian revolts more than a decade before. Herodotus tells us that Xerxes actually planned this this campaign for more than 4 years for how to conquer Greece. And I take it then that the banquet we are reading about in verse refers to the final 6 months of military strategizing for this campaign. Now, for this campaign, we know that there are some inflated ideas of the number of soldiers that he amassed, but about 200,000 soldiers and a naval fleet. And whether he knew it or not, he was embarking upon the greatest military, most important military campaign of his entire career. The campaign occurs between Esther 1 and 2, which are the years, you know, 481 to 479 BC. So when you come to Esther 2, understand that quite a bit of time has passed and this king has been on the warpath. Esther 2, you begin to read, and the demeanor of the king after this campaign. He was defeated. He was downcast. And it was at that time that he remembered, you know, Vashti, and she'd been banished, and so now he couldn't turn to her for comfort. And so instead his advisors suggested, well, you might want to just pick a new queen from all the finest virgins of Persia. What do you think about that? Oh, that sounds like a great plan. In any case, verse 3 then is referring to the final stages for the military strategy that Xerxes was developing against Greece that would ultimately be a failure. Now, well, although he did burn Athens, as we'll see, of course. Now, at this banquet, verse 4 describes he displayed the riches of his glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, 180 days. It was a show of wealth with all his military government officials, his nobles. It was a show of power. Okay? They were to be impressed by this, the greatest ruler on the face of the earth. And don't forget, the angel said in Daniel 11 that when he becomes powerful through his wealth, then he will carry out a campaign against the Greeks. So all of this is occurring to fulfill prophecy in Daniel 11. Now, after the military planning session ended, after 180 days, we come to scene 2 in verse 5, another banquet. The book actually begins and ends with two banquets, if you're interested in that type of thing. This one is not 180 days, but it's a 7-day banquet. It says, when these days were completed, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days for all the people who were present at the citadel in Susa, from the greatest to the least, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. All right, so it's springtime. It's nice outside. It's 482 B.C. The gardens are in full bloom. He gives an outdoor banquet for everyone you see who lived in the city of Susa. Now, you can see from this that the king is, he's very benevolent, is he not? I mean, why is he so benevolent at this time? Because he wants support for the war that he's about to launch. He doesn't need people trying to take over the government while he's in a campaign with Greece. He needs the nation's support. So he's a very smart ruler. He has this banquet for all these people who are present at the citadel of Susa, but actually it's just the men who are here, because verse 9 says what? That Queen Vashti gave a banquet for the women. So the banquet of the king is just for the men. It's stated to be in verse 5 from men from the greatest to the least. That's the upper and the lower class. There was stratification in this society. But all in this city were invited to the banquet regardless of class. And it was a great party. Okay, it was very patriotic. The colors are all there. Persian, notice verse 6, the national colors. White and violet linen hangings. These were like the Persian flags, and they were hanging on marble columns. Beautiful. By cords of fine purple linen on silver rings. So the Persian flags are flying in this outdoor garden park. Very lavish. He also has couches that are plated with gold and silver. And the pavement in the park was composed of mosaics of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. And this was an awesome display of Xerxes' wealth and the good king allowing all to enjoy it. Now, verse 7, there were not only all that, but there were drinks provided, and not only drinks, but drinks served in golden vessels of various kinds. And the royal wine was plentiful according to the king's bounty. Now, the mention of the various golden vessels, the Persians, for them, this was a luxury. You know, they loved to drink out of all different kinds of vessels. And people still like to do that today. But this was a Persian luxury. And the king provided all this, plus an abundance of the royal wine. So this is the very best wine that could be served. You know, stuff out of, I don't know, Napa or something. So I'm suggesting that he's doing all of this to keep up the popularity back home, to keep up the war effort back home when he's gone. Everyone is going to have this lasting impression of him as this great benevolent king as he departs for battle. Now, verse 8, the drinking was done according to the law. There was no compulsion, for so the king had given orders to each official of his household that he should do according to the desires of each person. Now, this too is very benevolent, okay, because the order of the day was that if you were at a host's party, that you would drink whatever the host served you, and to not drink it would be an insult to the host. But for this party, a special law, and the Hebrew actually is saying not that there was a law it's nobody had to drink according to compulsion. But for this party, a law was made that nobody had to drink whatever was served to them. You could just drink whatever you wanted, and it would be no insult to the king. And so this is a radical change from the normal ways that Persians carried out parties. Now, of course, this is a great party. It's going on here, and you've got all the men, and they're outdoors. But in verse 9, you have another party going on. This is Queen Vashti, and she has all the women. And they're in the palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. So they're indoors. And we have the men outdoors, we have the women indoors, and everybody says amen. All right, then we come to the third scene. And this is verse 10, and it's the seventh day. And at this point, everything is going according to the king's plan. I mean, put yourself in Xerxes' shoes. I mean, he's just finalized his brilliant military strategy. He has just shown off his massive wealth and power. He's shown everyone a good time. He's so benevolent. Everything was perfect. The heart, in verse 10, of the king was merry with wine. So, you know, what could make things better? Well, a beautiful woman's presence. That might make things better. We've been drinking and cajoling here for 6 days with no women. We need a woman. And who better than the most beautiful woman in the kingdom, the queen? So on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zithar, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs. How'd you like to be named Carcass? Okay. Anyway, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. But Queen Vashti refused to come. Now the problem is, everybody debates is why did she refuse to come? And some people say, well, it's obvious why she didn't come, because in verse 11, the king requested that she come with her royal crown, and her royal crown only, okay? this, you know, was too distasteful a thing for her to come in before all these men, so she didn't come in. Now, I'm not writing that off completely, but I doubt it. So other people say, well, she didn't come because her husband was drunk. Well, that may be. Maybe it was a bad drunk. Finally, other people say, well, she refused to come because, you know, she was so busy entertaining the women. I mean, she couldn't depart from that and leave them. And that may be. Okay. But the truth of the matter is, and if we'd been there, we might know more. But all we do know for sure is that she refused to come. And certainly this spoiled the king's plans. See, everything was working perfectly up until that moment for 186 days straight. He'd finalized his military plans. He'd shown off his impressive palace. He'd put on a patriotic, luxurious show in his royal garden park for all the men. He'd given them wine, luxurious drinking vessels. He'd been benevolent. But now he wanted to show off his wife next, and he was met with defeat. Now, the irony of the situation is that here is the richest, most powerful man in the inhabited world. He's about to embark on a great military campaign, and he cannot even command his own wife to come to him. How then is he going to command 200,000 soldiers and an entire naval fleet in a campaign against Greece? And it seems to me that the handwriting is on the wall. So his response at the end of verse 12 is really no surprise. The king became very angry, and his wrath burned within him. He was embarrassed. I mean, who wouldn't be as the king in that kind of a position? He couldn't let this go overlooked, as beautiful as she was. This rebellion from within his own house had to be dealt with. So verse 13, he follows custom. Then the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for it was the custom of the king, so to speak, before all who knew law and justice, and were close to him, Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marsena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media. You see, it was typical, of course, for ancient kings to have cabinet-level advisors surrounding you, and that's who these men were. They were the kind of men that we met in the book of Daniel when King Nebuchadnezzar had his dream, And he wanted the dream to be revealed, and he wanted the dream to be interpreted, and none of them could do it, but Daniel had to come in and give the proper interpretation of the dream. So you see, these men were those type of men, however, served in the top positions in the government. They knew law and justice, so they were lawyers. But also we know that at the beginning of verse 13, it describes them as wise men who understood the times. And this undoubtedly is recognized by scholars to be a description of those who were astrologers, or what we sometimes call magi. Not astronomers, that's a different science. Astrologers. Now, because we're in Persia, we're pretty certain that these were Zoroastrian astrologers. They were practicers of the religion of Zoroastrianism. And their belief, at least among the priests of this religion, was that they could read the stars and tell you what fate was, and they could even manipulate the fate that the stars foretold. Okay? Now, at this point, you see, things are not going the way that the king wants them to go. So he calls up these men who could, in his mind, manipulate the current situation and get them back on track for his success. So the king is turning basically to his religion to answer this problem, one that he thinks is going to solve his dilemma and get his destiny back on track to conquer Greece. Now, it seems from verse 16 and following that there really was no law regarding Queen Vashti. I mean, she's the queen. There was no law regarding how she has to obey the king or what. There may have been laws, and were other laws, I'm sure, for others who disobeyed the command of the king. But there was no law regarding the queen. And so the answer is not according to law. They're going to have to create a law. But the answer that Memucan gives is according to a wisdom principle. Okay, so let's look at the wisdom response. In the presence of the king and the princes, Memucan said, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but also all the princes and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. You say, well, that's a big problem. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands by saying, well, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought in his presence, but she didn't come. So this day, the ladies of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's conduct will speak in the same way to all the king's princes, and there will be plenty of contempt and anger. If it pleases the king, let a royal edict be issued by him, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media so that it cannot be repealed. Namely, that Vashti may no longer come into the presence of King Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal position to another who is more worthy than she. So this Memucan makes his proposal. We might speculate that he might have been having a few marital problems of his own. And maybe this was his quick solution to his own marital problems. But probably the solution has more to do with keeping peace and harmony in the kingdom when they are on the brink of war. They really didn't need what verse 17 describes as, you know, all the women looking with contempt on their husbands at a time of war. They really didn't need what he describes at the end of verse 18, plenty of contempt and anger, when they're about to go to war. What they needed on the home front was peace and harmony and order. And so Memucan suggests the king put forth a royal edict and have this put down in the official laws of Persia and Media that, you know, we will have no feminine liberal liberation movements at this time. Okay? We can talk about that later. Now, it's very interesting that Memucan's advice here does have a kernel of truth to it. I mean, it's not unreasonable at all in the sense that as goes the leadership of a nation, so goes the people of a nation. So if Queen Vashti were allowed to rebel against King Ahasuerus' command, then sure, all the women in the kingdom might be allowed to rebel against their own husband's commands, and this would cause plenty of contempt and anger. So verse 21 since the ball was in the king's court, and this counsel seemed wise at a time just before war, then the king commands in verse 21 that this be put into law. Okay? This word pleased the king, and the princes and the king did as Memucan proposed. Now remember, verse 10, the king was merry in his heart. Okay, he was drunk. others may have been drunk, but he was drunk. It says, verse 10, he may have sobered up by now. His wife didn't come, and he was embarrassed. But the Persians were very fond of wine. In fact, they were very fond of discussing deep matters when they were drunk on wine. Another quote there that you have underneath the one you just read before is from Herodotus again. And he says of the Persians, they are very partial to wine. It is their custom to deliberate about the gravest matters when they are drunk. And what they approve in their deliberations is proposed to them the next day when they are sober. This is a safe, this is how this is your backup, plan. By the master of the house where they deliberate. And if, being sober, they still approve it, they act on it. But if not, they drop it. Okay. So, it does sound like a good idea. So, apparently, following this procedure, what happened was, they discussed Memucan's proposal and approved it. But the next day, when the king sobered up, they still approved of it. So, you can't say this was just a rash, drunk decision. It would have been approved the next day, even when they were sober. So verse 22, he acts on it. And he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province according to its script, and to every people according to their language, that every man should be the master in his own house, and the one who speaks in the language of people. All right, now that's a lot of letters. He ruled a vast empire, as you can see. He had to send a letter to 127 different provinces. And you can see that from the description here, this kingdom had a lot of cultural and linguistic diversity. Okay, there were various scripts that were used and dominant in certain provinces, and so letters had to be written to certain provinces in various scripts. There were also various languages spoken in the kingdom, and we're realizing that more and more in our country, unfortunately. But it would not be until the time of Alexander the Great that he would recognize the importance of a single language being spoken. So the Persians didn't recognize this yet. They had many languages spoken in their provinces. But what they did recognize was that for the man of the house to be the man of the house, his language had to be the one that was spoken in the house. And that's what he's referring to in the last expression, which isn't translated so clearly, but the idea that every man should be the master in his own house, and the one who speaks in the language of his own people. The idea was that the father's native language should be the language that's spoken in each household. Now this of course wasn't typical, because the mother was the one who raised the little brats, and so she would speak to them in her own native language, and the little brats would pick up her language as the first language, and not their father's, and then, the mom and the kids are talking behind the dad's back, and who knows what's going on. Okay, you see the problem. But not any longer, says Xerxes. The language spoken in the house, he says, will be the language of the father, his native tongue. That way we don't have this nonsense going on behind the dad's back. So these letters were sent out to the whole kingdom in various scripts and various languages, and this is supposed to keep the peace and order and harmony on the home front during the campaign against Greece. Now, I don't know how they were going to, actually enforce this, but anyway. And so maybe it was a rash decision, but We could comment here on the postal delivery system. I'm not going to do so much. It's just enough to say that many scholars think that the Persians were actually the ones who developed the Pony Express system. And there's extensive quotations I could give you from Herodotus that explain how they one horse rider to another horse rider all over, and how rapidly they could transmit the mail. But the important thing is that we recognize God's providential work in all of this. Okay, so let's conclude with that. What can we take away from this? And I've got these all listed on your handout, some of the conclusions. The first one, at the bottom of the left side of the page, is that all these people in this story were doing exactly as they wanted to do. But what was happening was exactly what God wanted to do. Now, they could not possibly have known that. But because Esther has been written, the curtain has been pulled back, and now we are getting a glimpse at how God runs history. Let me give several examples. There are three underneath that first point. Okay? First of all, the queen had her own reasons for refusing to come to before the king and display her beauty. But God's reason for the refusal was so that Memucan would make his proposal. Otherwise, he never would have made this proposal. Second, Memucan had his own reasons for proposing the king make a royal edict banishing Vashti from his presence. Perhaps it was his own marital problems. But God's reason was so that the office of queen was empty and prepared for who? Esther. Third, the king planned to conquer the Greeks and expand his kingdom, but God planned for the king to lose the war and be downcast in chapter 2 and seek solace in his harem, where he would find who? Esther. Now, were these just happenstances, or was this all seen by divine design? The second lesson we can learn is that it's similar to the first, but we have to recognize that men may have their reasons for doing things, but God has other reasons for what they are doing. And while every man is doing what they want to do, God's plan ultimately comes to pass perfectly. You know, I don't know what all of our rulers, we can study and we can speculate as to why our rulers in our country are making certain decisions. Like, for example, why our president is supporting the sending of F-16s to Egypt right now, when the Muslim Brotherhood is in power and we know that they're terrorists and have been since the 1930s. Why is that? We may speculate as to why our president is doing that, but the fact that it's happening, that doesn't mean that's why God is allowing it to happen. God may be allowing it to happen for other purposes and setting up something for his plan to be fulfilled. And we studied that in Daniel 11, I think, a few weeks ago. So that's an example. Now, by application, let's make some applications to the life of Israel. And I think this is on the right side. First, think of how the Nazis had plans to exterminate the Jews in the 1930s and 40s. But God used this extermination plan to establish a Jews back in their own land. That's providence. Number two, think of how the Arab nations had plans in 1967 to destroy the Jews, but God's plan was to use this war to give Jerusalem back to the Jews. See, many, many plans of man, but God is the one who directs history, not man. Now, by application, let's make some applications in conclusion to our own lives, okay? I mean, you know, when you look back on your life, do you see God's providential work in your life? Do you see how he has worked to bring you from some place to the present place? It's so vital, I think, to learn this lesson from the book, that you look back on your own life and you recognize that God has a plan for your life and that you could have never dreamed of this plan. I mean, you had ideas and you planned your life and what it might be like, but it didn't really turn out that way most of the time. And it's vital, see, to take that hindsight as you now look back on your life, as you will this next week, I'm sure, and you will contemplate these things, and take your hindsight and what you learn from that about what God was doing here, here, and here throughout your life, and you apply that to your present circumstances to realize that even right now, God is working together in your circumstances, whether good or bad, for the good. He's working all things together for good, for those who love God, for those who are called according to His purpose. The verse does not say that everything that happens in your life is good. The verse says that God is working those things together for the good. There's an ultimate good conclusion in some way that you don't have a grasp of. But if you'll reflect on what God has done in the past in your life by hindsight and see the good that He did through some of those things to bring about this present situation in your life, then you can reason from that that God also has good in store for what is happening right now in your life. So can you accept that God is in charge of your life? Can you accept that He has a plan for your life and it may not be the one that's in your mind? While the one in your mind you may think is the best plan, can you accept that His is infinitely better? That's the challenge of the book. And can you adjust and accept His plan for your life? Can you do that? All right. So let's close with a word of prayer and certainly be impressed with the way God worked in the time of the deposed Vashti. And we'll get ready next week to see how Esther comes to be the queen of Persia. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank You, Lord, that You have pulled back the curtain and revealed remarkable things about the way which You work in history. Even though men don't acknowledge Your providential rule, certainly, Lord, we have been given eyes to see it through this book and by the work of the Holy Spirit in our lives. We thank You, Lord, that You've given us this book. We thank You, Lord, that it has a remarkable ending as You weaved a remarkable tapestry together of individuals of Your plan, all doing what they wanted to do at a certain given time. But in the end, ultimately, it was You who were the star, You who were the hero, You who brought it to pass and saved the Jews. We thank You for that, Lord, and we give You all the praise and the glory. We ask we might recognize these things in our life, too, that You're at work. We ask this in Jesus' precious name. Amen.